Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to Brains, a podcast exploring the inner workings of our brains and how film and television portray them. Hosted by me, writer-director Heather Taylor.
And by me, film and television editor Sarah Taylor. Before we begin, we want to acknowledge that the lands from which we recorded this podcast and from where you are listening are part of territories that have long served as a gathering place for diverse Indigenous peoples. And we are thankful, as guests on this land, to be able to live, work, and gather here together. We continue to learn about the history that came before us, and we encourage you to do the same.
Today, we're talking with Gretchen Sisson, a research sociologist with Advancing New Standards in Reproductive Health at the University of California, San Francisco. She is the author of Relinquished, The Politics of Adoption and the Privilege of American Motherhood, a critical 10-year examination of domestic adoption. Centering the stories of relinquishing mothers, the book chronicles America's refusal to care for families at the most basic level and instead allow cultural and political ideas of adoption to advance an individual, private solution to large-scale social problems.
Our conversation critically considers the function adoption has in our society and who it serves, who it fails, and who lives with the trauma as the result. We also discuss adoption representation in shows like This Is Us and 16 and Pregnant, and how women who Gretchen spoke with feel that The Handmaid's Tale is the closest representation to their experience of relinquishing their child.
A quick reminder to our listeners that this interview should not be taken as medical advice, and it is for informational purposes only. Because everyone's brain is different, please consult your healthcare professional if you have any questions. And now, Gretchen.
Gretchen, welcome to Brains.
Thank you guys for having me back.
I know, I'm so excited. You're our first, second time guest, and I'm thrilled that you're here.
Me too.
It's a great honor, and I'm thrilled to be back and chatting with you all. Thanks for having me.
Well, to refresh our listeners' minds, tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I'm a sociologist. I'm with Advancing New Standards in Reproductive Health, which is a research group at the University of California in San Francisco. And last time I was on the show, I was with my colleague Stephanie Harrell talking about our research around abortion and abortion storytelling in our popular culture. Today, I am back talking about my new book called Relinquished, The Politics of Adoption and the Privilege of American Motherhood. So broadly, my work is looking at abortion and adoption in American culture. So this is a slightly different area than what we talked about last time, a much heavier emphasis on my adoption research. But there's plenty of pop culture stuff in there, too, that I think we can take away because I can't help myself from talking about TV when I get the opportunity. So.
It's fantastic because that's exactly what we love to talk about. So we're really glad we've come together for a melding of minds with your expertise and our just love of film and television. Just to start off, what inspired you to write this book? And as you talk about that, what are the most surprising takeaways that you've had from your research?
That's a big question. Two big questions. I'll start and I'll give the TV answer, which is that it started with 16 and Pregnant on MTV back in the summer of 2009, 2010, when the show first started airing on MTV. And at the time, I was working with an organization called the Alliance on Teen Pregnancy in Boston. And I was doing a lot with pregnant teens and young mothers who were doing a lot of advocacy around lobbying the Boston City Council, lobbying the Massachusetts State Legislature for what they needed to support their families, their children. And I was really inspired by them and really struck by the incredible divergence between our cultural ideas about what teen pregnancy and young parenthood look like and what the actual lives of these young women looked like. And then 16 and Pregnant comes out on MTV. And of course, the young mothers that I was working with were really interested in watching this show that was supposed to be telling stories about their lives, people like them. And on that first season, there was a couple, Caitlin and Tyler, who relinquished their daughter for adoption. And the whole framing of the story, the arc over the season, was really that Caitlin and Tyler were better parents by virtue of relinquishing their daughter, right? They were more mature. They were more loving. They were better parents by being able to recognize that they couldn't actually raise their child. And you look at this in comparison to the other women on the show who were struggling in a lot of ways and had really thin support and were trying to figure out how to make it work. And this show was so stigmatizing of them and their decisions. And it really, again, just struck me the ways that adoption was viewed as this panacea, right? We don't need to support young families. We don't need to look at what the actual lives of young people are like. We can just say like, oh, they should just give away their children, like problem solved. And I was also volunteering at the abortion fund at the time. And this idea of adoption as a solution obviously recurs and within abortion politics and those conversations. And so it just sort of really struck me. And I wanted to understand the ways that adoption was actually lived out for the women who were most impacted by it and their children over time. But so I started doing interviews with mothers who have relinquished children in 2010. And then I did 10-year follow-up interviews with them in 2020.
From that, what surprised you the most?
I mean, what surprised me the most, I think, is really how poorly served the women were by adoption over time. Right. We have this idea that adoption is beautiful and easy and maybe sad, but like ultimately offers this better life for everyone involved. And it was so much more complicated than that, which wasn't, that part wasn't surprising. Things are always more complicated than the political rhetoric conveys them to be. But what was surprising was the extent to which almost all of the mothers ended up in a pretty cynical, critical place over time. And very few of them really felt good about the decisions that they had made.
When you asked relinquished mothers about the portrayals that resonated with them on film and TV, what were some of the good examples?
There's a difference between good examples, I think, and examples that actually resonated with them, mm-hmm. right? So, like, they hated Juno. They hated Juno, right? They had deep concerns about Juno. She just gave birth. Why is she riding a bike? We have concerns, right? Like, fair enough.
Oh my gosh. I haven't watched it since I gave birth. Oh my God. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
You know, like, this is legitimate. This is a legitimate question that they had. They had a lot of criticisms about Glee, a couple of depictions on Grey's Anatomy. They liked This Is Us to some parts more than others. The complexity of transracial adoption, a lot of that resonated with them. They did not like the adoption story at the end of the series. You know, so it was a lot of give and take. But one of the stories that they actually connected with the most was the story of The Handmaid's Tale and this idea of women who were effectively being used to create children for a ruling class of people within this patriarchal, theonomic state, right? And I think that the fact that that was the one that they most saw themselves in gives you pretty keen insight into how they're experiencing their decisions, the context in which their decisions were made, the amount of constraint that they felt, the social factors that were shaping their lives at the time. And so I thought that was really powerful.
Yeah. Wow.
So, you know, with these kind of examples you gave of these different shows that they maybe didn't find themselves in, you know, what are some of those tropes and stereotypes that have been reinforced by this, like, modern adoption stories in TV and film?
Yeah. So usually when you see stories about birth mothers or first mothers on TV, it's one of two things. One, the mother is like kind of entirely uninterested in her child, right? She moves on. She doesn't want to have contact. She's happy with her life, like had a baby, on to the next thing, right? That reflected no one's experience that I talked to. Then on the other side, in most cases where you have stories about birth mothers, they're viewed as a threat to the adoptive family, right? So if they do have any interest in a child, if they do want to be connected, it is threatening. Either they're like straightforwardly like, I'm trying to regain custody of my child. That's not a legal possibility in most cases, right? But like, or they're interfering, or they're dangerous, or they're risky, or they want to steal the child. Like, what is missing is a model for a birth mother who wants to stay engaged and involved in her child's life and isn't viewed as a threat to the family for that desire. That's what was missing from a lot of these stories, because that's what almost all of the mothers I spoke with, that's where they were. They wanted to have contact. They wanted to have more contact than they did, But most of them had a lot of respect for their child's adoptive parents. And even if they were really frustrated, even if they were really upset with their child's adoptive parents, they recognized that they were not going to be regaining custody of their child, right? They recognized that they didn't actually have any power in this situation to do that. They just wanted to know their kid as they were growing up. And I think that this part of the challenge with open adoption and with navigating open adoptions is that even though that's the norm with an adoption, like 95% of adoptions today are open in some way. But part of the reason why those relationships are hard to navigate long term is because they kind of remain a cultural oddity. Like most people who are outside of the adoption communities don't have an understanding of why a birth mother would want to be there. We don't see those stories told in our popular culture. And so I think that is what's missing the most.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just to follow that up, like why is there this focus on adoptive parents' desires versus the desires or the wants of the relinquishing mother?
Yeah. Well, adoption is always the transfer of children from families with less power to families with more, right? That's why the children are up for adoption in the first place. So that can be about resources, you know, it can be about, it's usually about resources, but it can be about other things as well. Race, it can be about gendered ideas of who gets to be a parent on what terms, certainly. Usually, again, two middle-class families, mostly white, largely heteronormative white families. And who has the power to tell stories in our culture, right? Who are the policymakers?
Right.
Who are the screenwriters? Right. And I will say, like, when we hear these refrains of story, like adoption is beautiful, adoption as family building, like that's the adoptive family perspective, right?
Yeah.
And we lose sight of the fact that for every family that is formed in adoption, a family is separated to make that adoption possible. And those are the stories that we are missing.
How does this pop culture narrative about, you know, relinquished mothers shape people's biases, and how do they shape the social and political narratives of that dictate the U.S. policies or any government policy around family and adoption?
We as a country, as a society, believe so many things about adoption that just aren't really true, mm-hmm. right? And I think a lot of them come back to a lot of these stories that we tell about adoption. So we have this persistent belief that there are a lot of babies in need of homes, right? That adopting an infant is an altruistic thing to do, that we need more families to do that. We don't. We have between 10 and 45 waiting families for every infant that's available, right? So there's a huge, huge, huge demand for infants. There is almost no supply, right? And when you have that system within a market-based economy, you know, then the facilitators are going to be incentivized to generate more supply. And again, we're talking about human beings when we're talking about this supply, right? And I think when we focus on stories that are about adoptive families, right, we are losing sight of that dynamic mm-hmm. that is encouraging family separation. So I think that is a really important myth that we have about adoption. But it also plays into this continual idea that people who are poor are incapable parents, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't want to dismiss the challenges of parenting in poverty, but I also want to acknowledge that millions of American families do that every day, right? And when we look down on poor parents, then we feel increasingly justified in surveilling them, questioning the decisions that they're making for their children, questioning their right to parent under certain circumstances, questioning their worthiness. And then that's when we get more comfortable separating families and we don't see a necessity or a benefit to trying to keep families together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think we see a lot of stories that kind of reflect both of those dimensions. And you know, I think it's important to recognize where that comes from.
Oof, that really makes me feel emotional.
Yeah, like I feel shitty right now because I never, like I've been so invested, I guess, in the narrative I've seen my whole life that, yeah, we're making families and I never really took the time to think about the families that are being taken apart. And like, that's really heartbreaking.
Well, we don't need to feel shitty. I do think that we should think about it more, though.
Yeah, no, I think we should think about it for sure.
Yeah. Because I think that this is just a reflection of privilege.
Yes.
Right? And it's who you see in your communities. And I will also say, because the stories of birth and first mothers are silenced and erased in a lot of different ways, both because they have less power to get traction, but like in some fairly straightforward ways, like a lot of the mothers I interviewed, they were like, Are you going to change my name? Yes, of course. Are you going to change my child's name? Are you going to remove these? Like, yes. Yes, I'm committed to protecting your identity to the extent that I can, right? One of the reasons they are so concerned is because if they are in an open adoption, and again, most of them were to some extent, if they anger their child's adoptive parents, they can have their contact with their child limited, right? If their child was over 18, they were generally more comfortable sharing their stories. If their child was under 18 and that relationship was still contingent on the cooperation of the adoptive parents, they were much more hesitant to share their stories. And then for mothers who were in a really critical place, you know, there have been adoption agencies that have sent cease and desist letters for birth mothers who have like written blogs that were really critical of the adoption system or accusing the agencies of manipulating or coercing them. Adoption agencies have had lawsuits against birth mothers. It doesn't take a lot, right? If you have one lawsuit against one birth mother, soon a lot of people are going to know about that and they're going to pull back in how they share their stories. Mm-hmm. Again, not only is there sort of this cultural silencing because of a lack of power, but there's also like really intentional efforts to try to keep some of these stories from being told. And so a lot of times I'll be in interviews and people will be like, well, I never met a birth mother. I never talked to a birth mother. And I was like, well, you don't know that you did, but like, maybe you do, right? Which is the same thing I say when people are like, I don't know many people who've had abortions. I was like, oh, you 100% do, right? It's less likely that you know a birth mother than that you know someone who had an abortion, because adoption is comparatively so rare and abortion is so incredibly common. But, you know, since I started doing this research, a woman I knew in college, she's like, oh, I relinquished my son before we started college. I never knew that. I knew this woman for years, right? And she shared that with me. Or, you know, a friend who was like, oh, my sister relinquished her baby, ruined her life, right? This 40 years ago. Or a friend of mine who, you know, was playing around on 23andMe last summer and discovers a brother that she never knows she had. And her mother had passed a couple years ago. And so she's discovered this brother that her own mother relinquished, right? Mm-hmm. These stories are all around us. We just don't see them. They aren't allowed to be visible to us.
I got a little teary because like of our background, like growing up in poverty and growing up with a parent with mental illness and being scared and having her being sued for custody of one of our siblings. And it's just like, it's scary because the idea that she was seen as less than. Mm-hmm. And like, yeah, a lot of people, that power dynamic, and you just saying the power dynamic that stays throughout the entire relationship until that child turns 18, what a burden that is for that mother, that they want to be so careful, right? They just...
I mean, a lot of mothers talked about it almost like a sentence, right? Like, my child is 9, I'm halfway there, right? Like, so many of them are counting down to their child's 18th birthday until they can feel like they can have more of a connection. That's not all of them, right? Yeah. A lot of there, you know, and there are intermediate milestones. Like, a huge milestone was when their children got their own phones, right? And they could text, their kid could text them when they needed to. And they know that, oh, the adoptive parents are like checking their text messages. And, you know, they're aware that these conversations are happening. But just the idea that their child could text them whenever they wanted, like, that was really satisfying to a lot of them, that not every communication needed to like initially go through the adoptive parents, right? So I don't want to make it sound like every adoptive parent is completely cutting it off. Some of them did, but there are plenty of really well-meaning adoptive parents who do want to include the birth parents in their child's life, but there was still a constant anxiety there for a lot of them. One of the best examples, there's when I interviewed her in 2010 and she was feeling really good about her adoption. And she talked about when she babysat her child for a weekend. His adoptive parents were going to a wedding, and so she babysat him for a weekend. And she felt great about this at the time. And 10 years later, I was like, do you remember when you told me this story about when you got to babysit your son? And she said, oh yeah, did I tell you that he fell off the bed? And I was like, no. You know, but at this point, I've had 3 kids. Every single one of them fell off the bed, right? When they were at that age, right? They learned a roll. And of course, they learned a roll when you've walked away from the side of the edge of the bed for a minute. And that's how that goes. Her anxiety around him rolling off the bed as a 1-year-old, she talked about setting an alarm on her phone for every 5 minutes overnight and like staying next to the crib to make sure that he was okay, because she was so worried that if he got hurt, his adoptive parents would cut off contact. Mm-hmm. I mean, these were adoptive parents who trusted her, right? They left their child with his birth mother, like, for the weekend, right? Like, that's a tremendous show of trust and faith and connection. But that anxiety was still there. that worry was still there the whole time that she had him. She was worried, if I take him to the hospital, is, you know, are they going to forgive me? Right. And I think that, and I mean, she was telling me this story like 8 years or over 10 years after it happened. Right. And it was still, you could still hear the anxiety in her voice as she spoke about it. So, yeah, I think that there is that power differential that really never goes away.
Yeah. So why? Okay. We just like big questions here. Why is modern adoption so complex? And what has changed, if anything, from pre-Roe adoption?
Okay. That is a lot of question. I'm going to start with the second one. I'm going to start with the second one. And we'll see. So before Roe v. Wade, and really for a while after Roe v. Wade, private adoption was predominantly a white system. So it was really white women that were participating in the private adoption system almost exclusively. There are a couple of reasons for that, but mostly because there was a market for white babies that there wasn't for children of color. I don't want to make it sound like those families were protected from family separation. They weren't. But it wasn't, they weren't separated for the benefit of the private adoption market. There were also like longer histories of single motherhood within Black communities, of kinship care within Black and Latina and tribal communities that were very real. So mostly pre-Roe, we look at private adoption, it was young, white girls and young women whose own parents said, you are not allowed to have a child before you're married. We're going to send you a maternity home. This is a way of delaying motherhood until you are married. This is the first child, right? And like, that's how this is going to be handled. Because the stigma and shame of non-marital pregnancy and premarital parenthood was too much in sort of this like very conformist post-World War II society in these white communities, right? And so that was what private adoption looked like then. On the other hand, whereas communities of color didn't face that same market demand or those same pressures in the same way, the child welfare system, the family regulation system was also used as a way of separating particularly Black families. And of course, the boarding school tradition in used against Native American communities, and then the Indian Adoption Project that followed that into the 1970s. These communities were still separated from their children in a lot of ways, but it wasn't to make children available for private adoption, right? I still think that those narratives inform how we think about which families get support for which reasons, which parents have a right to their children, and what that looks like. So it's not independent, right? They're not separate issues, but they're separate systems that are working in parallel ways. After Roe v. Wade, domestic adoption drops pretty quickly, unsurprisingly. Slowly, you see the introduction of open adoption at that point. That's a way to encourage more women to participate in the private adoption system. If they have more control, you can pick the parents, you can get pictures. That was sort of like the extent of what openness looked like when we look at like the 80s, early 90s. You also start to see a huge increase in transnational, international adoption at the time. Right. So I was in elementary school in the 90s. Like my classmates that I knew who were adopted, they were all international adoptees, right? They were from Korea, South and Central America, China for sure. That is where the majority of adoption came from in the 90s, kind of through early 2000s. And that accomplished a couple of things. One is it established that there was a market among white adoptive families for children of color, right? And two, it alleviated some of the demand on the domestic adoption space. But once the international adoption market crashed, as countries sort of stabilized geopolitically or economically, they stopped exporting their children. A lot of restrictions on international kind of happened all at once in the early 2000s. Then there became this issue of, well, now where are we going to source children? And that is when you see a lot more work happening. And it started in the early 90s of fast-tracking adoptions from the foster care system for permanent adoption, terminating parental rights more quickly, and then also increasing openness within the private adoption system even further to make it even more appealing. And this framing of adoption as an empowered choice, right? That this is a pregnancy option. You can choose this instead of having an abortion. And this is where you see a lot of the really adoptive adoption promotive rhetoric that we see coming out there. That was an incredibly complicated history that I just tried to do some amount of justice to in like 3-4 minutes. I'm glossing over a lot of important detail, but that is sort of the general arc that we've seen. And that sort of shapes the contours of what domestic private adoption looks like today, where it is really entangled with the family policing child welfare systems. You continue to have really high demand for all children, especially all healthy babies, even as you have relatively low supply. And so I think that has all led to the factor that contributes most to relinquishment being poverty. Mm-hmm. Across the board. Mm-hmm. So most of the women that I interviewed for this book wanted to parent their children. They continued their pregnancies with the intention of parenting, but they did not have the resources to have the capacity to raise another child.
Yeah. So, you know, I think you touched on our next question about like what types of motherhood and children and families are most valued by our society. I feel like that answers some of that question. But how does that belief of who is valued and who isn't valued, how does it impact politics and policies?
Right. So we spend a lot of money on adoption in the United States. We put a lot of private money into adoption. We put a lot of philanthropic money into adoption, promoting adoption, supporting nonprofit agencies. Mm-hmm. And we put a lot of public money into adoption. And I don't just mean through the family regulation system, right? We give tax subsidies to adoptive parents from the private adoption system as well. On the federal level, it's a $16,000 tax credit right now for an adoption to cover the cost of the adoption.
Really?
Yes.
How much does an adoption cost? Just as, sorry, the side note.
Well, so this is, they're expensive. They can go from like $20,000 to $40,000, $50,000. Depending on where you are. The argument is that we need to subsidize adoption because adoption is so expensive. My argument is that adoption is so expensive because you subsidize it.
Yeah.
So when you look at adoption agencies, right, really, really, really high demand, really, really low supply. If they're going to facilitate adoptions, they need to go out and market and find vulnerable pregnant people to sell the idea of relinquishment to. Right. So the number one expense for a lot of adoptions is not legal fees. It is not support for the birth parent. It is marketing. It is Google ads. Right. And so you're putting a ton of money into subsidizing the cost of an adoption, whereas a lot of the cost of the adoption is convincing someone that an adoption needs to take place. If you took a fraction of that and use it to keep families together, you wouldn't need to have the adoption happening in the first place. Right. And if you devoted those taxpayer dollars, and it's not just the tax credits, it's the tax breaks for the nonprofit agencies, the subsidizing of crisis pregnancy centers that work closely with adoption agencies, right? All of that money, in addition to the philanthropic money that goes into the adoption space.
What are some of the circumstances that lead to adoption? I think you've touched on some of that stuff, a lot of that stuff. But what consequences does it have for those who have relinquished their children and the children who have been relinquished? Like, what's the actual impact and the kinds of trauma that they might have?
So most of the mothers, almost really all the mothers that I interviewed, did go through this initial grief process after the adoption. This is a loss. They have to mourn it as a loss. And that is real. Mm-hmm. For some of them, a lot of them, after they get through that initial grief period, there is a period that a lot of them call like their adoption honeymoon, or, you know, the sunshine and rainbows period, or however you want to frame it, right? And that was a space where they were usually feeling really optimistic about the adoption, right? They're usually in a similar place to where they were at the time of the adoption. They're not that far out. They still have a great relationship with their child's adoptive parents. The kid is a baby. Adoption seems to be working well for all of them. They're super optimistic about how this is going to go. Things are great. And this is when adoption agencies invite them back to speak to prospective adoptive parents. They have them write blog posts. They have them do videos, right? Like I always say, it's not that hard to find a happy birth mother. You just need to, like, it's just a temporal thing rather than a geographic thing. You have to just find them right in that window. And, you know, I spoke with one woman. Actually, maybe I'll read a bit.
Yeah, please.
Please do.
So Leah, this is Leah. When we first spoke, just over a year after the adoption, Leah was candid that she was still grieving, but she did feel that the intensity of her mourning was starting to ease up a bit. Other birth mothers had prepared her by saying that the first year would be the worst, so she'd expected it, and it felt like she was emerging on the other side. Leah's candid feelings about her adoption were complicated, but she focused on how hard life would have been if she'd been parenting, and how much better she believed the adoption was for her son. Her hopefulness was earnest, and when I asked her what she thought adoption should look like, she said, "Mine. I think every adoption should look like mine. You know, mine wouldn't work for everybody, and not every birth mom will be comfortable. It's very hard for birth parents to feel confident in that relationship and to feel like they're bringing something to the table. I think society still considers open adoption as something that's done for the birth parents. I think it's really important if the birth mom starts to pull away for adoptive parents to remind her that they want her to be involved, that they think she does bring something to the table, that they value her, all of those things. Caleb is one now. He recognizes me. He's very comfortable with me. There are times when he won't go to his grandparents, but he'll come to me. He's aware of who I am, and when they talk about me, they say birth mom. When Jacqueline tucks him in at night, it's mommy loves you, daddy loves you, Leah loves you. There are pictures of me in their house. It's like I'm part of their family. It feels like a natural relationship. We never really wrote out a contract. It wasn't like that. The relationship will go as it is, but it's never going to be less than this. I feel like we've put a lot of work into it. When I have other children, when I get married, all of those things, that will change any family relationship. But I feel like this base level of love and respect for one another will help us carry through the times when there's not so much contact." Leah's excitement about adoption was sincere and buoyant, so it was no surprise that she was eagerly working as a peer counselor at the agency that had facilitated her adoption. They couldn't have asked for a better ambassador. So that was in 2010. I spoke with Leah again in 2020. She was still living in the same city with Ryan, Jacqueline, and Caleb, just a short 30-minute drive away. She hadn't had any more children, but she'd been happily married for just over 7 years. She was working at a job she seemed to like and had a fair amount of stability and comfort in her own life. "When I interviewed you in 2010, I began, you told me that you thought every adoption should look like yours." She sighed. "Oh yeah, that sounds like something I would have said." She continued, "I personally feel a whole lot different about adoption now. With the benefit of hindsight and some time and space and counseling and all that, I realize how much of my own trauma led to the adoption. I see it now as really unnecessary, unfortunately. But, you know, we are where we are, and we've been making the most of where we are and where we stand." Reflecting back on her relinquishment, Leah felt during her pregnancy that she had nothing to offer Caleb, so he wouldn't suffer from losing her. He could only gain. "The biggest thing that was never discussed anywhere in any space I was in while I was pregnant, and I tried to do a lot of research, like I really tried to, was adoption trauma for adoptees. She now felt like she had failed her son by the choices she'd made." And it goes on, and she's still in contact with Caleb. She hadn't been cut off. She saw him fairly regularly. They were still local to one another. But you can see sort of this shift, right? Where early on, she feels really confident that they have this good base. Everything's going to go well. This is the right decision. And as time passed on, she came to have a much more critical evaluation of what she'd been told during her pregnancy, the options that had been available to her, what she believed she was going to accomplish for her son through the adoption. And I think that this gets to the second part of your question, Sarah, which is that adoption is viewed as sort of this, only this net gain, only this door to a better life for adopted people. And it is far more complicated than that. So many adoptees are struggling with trauma around their adoptions, or simply struggling with, you know, not having a connection to their birth family, not having a strong connection. This is particularly palpable for transracial adoptees. And I'm always clear, my research is not on adopted people, right? I hope my research is accountable to them. You know, I hope that these stories are meaningful for them. I cite a lot of adoptee memoirists and scholars in this book. That was a priority for me, you know, but I haven't researched adoptee trauma. What I will say is that a lot of what changed how birth mothers felt about their adoption was seeing the ways that adoption did not accomplish for their children what they had hoped it would, right? So if their child is struggling in some way, they have a lot of questions. Or simple, I mean, not simple, but more straightforward things like, I relinquished my child because I was single at the time and I really strongly believed that my kid needed to have a two-parent family. And within 4 years, the adoptive parents are divorced and the birth mother is married and parenting her own kids with her new spouse, right? And like, What? Why did I make this decision, this lifelong decision, off of these circumstances that were likely to change, that in fact did change mm-hmm. dramatically? Mm-hmm. You know, and so I think that there was a lot of that, of seeing that whatever they had believed they were giving their child through the adoption, that promise did not materialize or never fully delivered to the extent that agencies had said that it would.
How does being an adoptee impact how people understand their own pregnancy and the impact of relinquishing a child?
Yes, and that's a great question, because adoptees are overrepresented among birth mothers, right? And the one thing that I want to express in that regard is it's not because they were so happy with their adoptions that that made sense, right? When adoptees have unplanned pregnancies, they have complicated feelings, right? Because so much public conversation about adoptees is like, you've been saved from abortion. Right? If you're unhappy in your adoption, like, would you rather have been aborted or left in a dumpster? Like, adoptees hear this bullshit all the time. And like, you know, I see it on social media because I'm connected to a lot of adopted people there. I see it. It's disgusting. It's constant. And I don't know how they deal with it other than the fact that they have no choice. But all of this conversation means that when adoptees have unplanned pregnancies, it's complicated for them. It's yeah. complicated for them to consider abortion and what abortion means in their lives. Plenty of adopted people do have abortions. I don't want to make it like more adoptees have abortions than relinquish, for sure. Yeah. Again, just because adoption is rare and abortion is so common. But for the adoptees who did relinquish, that was a factor. Also, if they were young, right, they were still really heavily influenced by their own adoptive parents. And if the adoptive parents perceive that the adoption was really successful and happy and easy, even if the adoptee has complicated feelings about it, probably the adoptive parents are going to be encouraging the adoption.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that came up frequently as well. So again, none of them were like, well, I was adopted and it was so wonderful that that's what I wanted to give my child. But just the salience of adoption in their own lives, I think, made them consider it earlier, more fully in their pregnancies, made them have more complicated feelings about deciding not to have an abortion. For adoptees of color, it was particularly fraught, especially adoptees of color who were raised by white parents, right? When they, you know, there's one woman I interviewed who was a transnational adoptee. She was from Central America, so she's Latina, and she was raised by white parents. And she's like, look, I didn't know who my child's adoptive parents were going to be, but they were not going to be white. Like, that was my number one priority, was that she felt so alienated, surrounded by whiteness growing up, that she really wanted her child to be with a family of color. The only family of color that the agency offered her was an Asian American family. And so that's what she chose. That's what she went with, right? And so you have these like various dislocations of racial and ethnic identity, of heritage, you know. And she said that she's in an open adoption. Her daughter is Latina. But as she said, I can't share that culture with her. Like, I was raised in a white household. We would have to learn this together. Mm-hmm. If she needs help navigating that, I can't give her that. Or adoptees in transracial adoptions who are biracial and only have a connection with their white mother, mm-hmm. right? And so even if they are connected to their family of origin, they're still not connected to their Black family, maybe.
Right.
And so this is getting a little bit further afield from your original question, but I think that it just brings up all of the ways that people's identities in these spaces are really complicated.
So now, what's the connection between adoption and reproductive justice? And how did the nationwide legal right to abortion in the U.S. start with an adoption?
Yes. Well, you know, Norma McCorvey, who was Jane Roe, never had an abortion. And people get confused about this, right? Of course she had an abortion. No, the case takes way too long. You know, she was pregnant at the time they filed it. The decision didn't come down for 3 years. Norma McCorvey actually relinquished 3 children over the course of her life. And like, I want to be clear, and I hope I am clear in this section where I talk about Norma. Norma was like not a reliable witness for her own life. She had a lot of trauma that happened. She was highly motivated. You know, she sort of established this identity as Jane Roe, as a pro-choice advocate, felt really alienated from the pro-choice movement, largely because she wasn't polished. She didn't fit in with like this repro rights, professionalized lawyerly set. They looked down on her a lot. I mean, like, she had legitimate grievances there. So then she's like, well, move to the pro-life side. She became this pro-life advocate. She wrote two different memoirs. They're almost entirely unreconcilable. and I think she was highly motivated by money, by attention. I'm not making any excuses for Norma here, but I do think that when I read her stories and accounts as a birth mother, I see someone who's been through a lot of trauma by virtue of those relinquishments and those separations, whose motherhood was never validated within the pro-choice side of the movement, whose person was never validated within that movement, whereas the anti-abortion movement was always willing to see her as a mother, was always willing to acknowledge her as a mother and make space for that. Right. And so I think she's a really interesting character. I don't want to draw too many conclusions from her story because, again, she's a deeply untrustworthy person in really recounting anything. But I have had more sympathy for her by understanding the stories of other birth mothers and what she went through. Mm-hmm. But the reason why I include that in the book is to say that this moment of Roe versus Wade, this establishment of legal abortion across the country, it was rooted on the constraint choices that Norma really reflected through her own story. We're beyond that now. We're beyond that in a couple ways. Roe is gone, first of all, but we're also beyond and should be beyond this pro-choice, pro-life dichotomy here, right?
Yeah.
And this is where I think feminists, the pro-choice movement, have consistently misunderstood adoption because they have always said, well, adoption is a choice. We are pro-choice. You can choose adoption. You can choose abortion. You can choose to parent, like 1, 2, 3 choices. Great, right? But what that has never been able to recognize are the conditions under which women relinquish, the constraints that are put on them that bring them to the point of relinquishment. And that's what reproductive justice offers, right? And reproductive justice has always been about a counterpoint to the pro-choice movement, right? As this theory and movement building that was founded by Black women that came out as a response to the pro-choice movement of saying, no, we need to be accountable to the conditions under which people are choosing to have children, under the options that are available to them, what real access looks like, and what their communities look like, and whether they're safe to have families in.
Yeah.
And so I think that reproductive justice is a natural philosophical home for adoption. The question of incorporating adoption into the reproductive justice movement as a basis for organizing and change making, that is trickier. Movement building is always trickier, and bridge building is always trickier. And the historical whiteness of private adoption makes it hard to make some of those connections. And so the work of bringing the conversations around adoption into the reproductive justice movement has largely fallen on not birth mothers, but on adopted people. And of course, on really adopted women of color who have come out of that, who are already occupying space in the reproductive justice movement and are now saying, let's bring adoption into this conversation.
It's so interesting because adoption is often seen as mutually agreeable common ground.
Yes.
Politically. And it's also this cultural narrative, it just praises adoption. Where is this coming from? Like, how do we bridge that belief with, you know, where we are now with reproductive justice to help us like fold that in and to say that this is part of a bigger narrative?
Yeah. I mean, look, conservatives obviously love adoption. They love it as it gives a counterpoint to abortion. That's great. But it also means that they don't have to invest in vulnerable families, right? They don't need to find broader social solutions to the things that make people more likely to relinquish. So that's great. For as far as they're concerned, our side likes adoption because we love this idea of sort of non-traditional family building, that love makes a family, right? A lot of gay and queer families adopt. And that's an important constituency on the political left. But I think it's actually not that. I think we have just largely conceded adoption as the ground of the right wing, right? And we have just said, this is an easy thing that we can compromise on. Because we don't understand it. Mm-hmm. So Right. We'll just say like, oh, this is pro-choice. You can choose any of these things and we're going to promote adoption. We're going to make adoption more accessible. We're going to subsidize adoption, right? Because again, policymakers have never considered what that actually means. Mm. And I'm not like letting them off the hook, right? They should be doing that, right? But I think as a movement, the abortion rights movement has never done a good job of incorporating it, and thus there's no one that's holding them accountable with any power in this space.
Right.
The biggest thing is like, we don't know how it works. Like just like the fact that we don't know how adoption works. Like it's just like, oh, that's an easy option. Sure. Yeah. It's a choice. You choose it.
Yeah. Look, people are always like, what do you want to accomplish with this book? And I'm like, I would just let people think about it a little bit more. Like I think a lot of this just comes from not critically considering the function that adoption has in our society and who it serves and who it fails. And I think that that's really important. And if my book can just get people to kind of question some of these premises that they see in our political conversations and our popular culture, I mean, that's what I'm trying to accomplish. You know, I get to a pretty radical place by the end of the book because that's where my research took me.
Yeah.
Right. I didn't start there. But that's where the stories went for me. And if I can do some handholding and help people along on this journey of understanding how this works, that's what I want the book to accomplish.
And speaking of pop culture, like what can pop culture do better? What stories would you love to see in film and television that can help us maybe shape some of this narrative in a better way?
The show that I love, that I actually feel speaks most directly to this work, is Made, based on Stephanie Land's book, because it shows the reality of parenting in poverty, what it takes to make it work. And then, you know, at the beginning of the show where she's involved in the custody battle with her ex and like having her parenting surveilled, mm-hmm. put under scrutiny. Like, I think that's really valuable. Like, that is the story of a family preservation as far as I'm like from my adoption perspective. This is the story that we need to see to show what parenting in poverty actually looks like, mm-hmm. so that we can understand why these families are worth investing in. Mm. Right. Like, that is to me like has nothing to do with adoption. But it has everything to do with adoption. It has everything to do with who we understand is worth being a parent. And I think that's really valuable. You know, I think we need, you know, Rebecca Nagel did incredible reporting with This Land and her reporting on the Indian Child Welfare Act. I think there is huge opportunity for storytelling there, mm-hmm. around the ways that we have policed and separated Native American families and tribes, the child welfare system, family policing there. I think that there are a lot of stories to be told. And I do think that there are stories to be told about private adoption too. You know, I think that, and this is why I chose to include so many first-person accounts in the book, like extended first-person accounts, because anything that I can say as a scholar is going to be less persuasive than just understanding how all of these various historical, sociocultural forces come together in one person's life and lead them to view adoption as the lifeline, mm-hmm. right? And that's what I think is important. And that's good storytelling. You can tell a story about that. Right. And I think that, you know, I'm hoping that we'll see more of these stories again. And they don't need to be overtly about adoption. They just need to be about the work and struggle of parenting for so many families today.
Yeah. Whew. Well, can you tell our listeners where they can find your book?
You can find it anywhere. Anywhere you buy books. It'll be on Bookshop. It'll be at your local bookstore. It'll be on Amazon. It will be on audiobook for people who prefer to read that way. I'm actually really excited about the audiobook. We're going to have a cast of authors reading some of the different stories. So nice. It was really important to me that it include different voices because the book quite literally includes different voices. So we will have that out. And no, I'm excited for it to be in front of people after all this time.
And can you say the name of your book one more time?
Yes, it is Relinquished, The Politics of Adoption and the Privilege of American Motherhood.
Oh, amazing.
Gretchen, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
Of course. Thank you, Sarah and Heather, for having me. I appreciate getting a chance to chat with you.
It was a pleasure.
I realized in talking with Gretchen that I didn't really ever think about the whole world of adoption. I had the movie lens on, the like happy family lens on. It was really impactful listening to her talk about her book and like the research she's done. I thought it really shifted my mindset.
Yeah.
Made me think of things in a way different way.
I think the key point of it is that it's not to take away from yes, it is making families, but in making families, it is also pulling apart families. Mm-hmm. And so I think there is that dichotomy there. And with pulling apart a family, you are also creating trauma. And so it just becomes such a complex issue. And I think a lot of people don't think about it. And that's kind of what you said. You have to critically think about this and who is benefiting and what stories are you painting of who and whom. And it just made me think, yeah, that is something that's just so prevalent in our society and in our politics and in our laws and in everything that it's important to really consider and think about.
Yeah, it made me do a lot of thinking. So thank you, Gretchen.
And thank you to everyone who was able to share their story to whatever capacity they were able to at the time. And understanding that that was a hard thing to do, both emotionally, psychologically, but also in some cases could have impacted their ability to have a relationship with their child. So
yeah,
I think just thank you to everyone who took part. I'm going to move us 180 degrees away from the conversation that we've had with Gretchen, which is so impactful, to say something that has been impactful for me. There's this app called Finch. There's a lot of these apps that are like, create a to-do list and then do the things in the day. And it's so boring and I don't know why and I've never wanted to do it.
I have one that's on my phone that I've started and never used because it got boring. So yes, tell me more.
So I have Finch, and in Finch, you basically set your goals and you can do just easy goals. So mine is brush my teeth twice a day, wash my face twice a day. And I'm going to say that it can be difficult for people to do that. And I am one like at night, I don't want to.
Yeah, I don't do it at night.
I hate doing it at night because I'm tired, but it's one of my goals in my thing. It make my bed, leave the house once a day. Because after I told my therapist that sometimes I don't leave the house for 3 days, she said you should leave the house every day. Fine. Do 3 minutes of an exercise that I enjoy. And then I put some things around sleeping. And you can have, there's a free version and a paid version. I use the free version. And so every day you do these tasks and you send your little bird. So it's Finch. So you have a little bird.
Oh, it's a bird. Okay.
And you name your bird. My bird is named Bluey after Bluey. So it's called Baby Bluey. And now it's Toddler Bluey because I've been using it for a while. So it grew up. So your bird grows up and you teach it things. So it goes on an adventure and it says, for instance, one of them was like, I saw a black cat and everyone tells me that they can be scary. What should I do? And then one answer is you could just stay, you know, away from it, or you can stay away from it and watch it and see if it's really true, if it's scary. Mm. And then when you click that one, you get your bird grows in curiosity.
That's about curiosity. Yes, 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 yes.
Yes. So I think like it's so interesting. And then what you can do is like, so Blue goes on an adventure every day. Once you do a few tasks, so you have to do at least like 4 little tasks and you get points. And then you can get, you earn these crystals and you can buy new clothes for your bird. You can buy furniture to help them like make their place nice. So, and you earn all these things by doing real world tasks. Mm-hmm. And it's so good because I have for the last 10 days that I've been using this, I have brushed my teeth in the morning and at night, and I have to so I can get my points with Bluey.
So it's good for you because it's a game.
It's a game.
Yes, that's it's the best
a game,
part of it.
And that's the best part of it. And it is a fun game. And then throughout the day, it does check-ins and it's like, Bluey has something to say. And like my last one that just came up when Sarah was here was, and they're all affirmation-based. And this one was, it's on my thing, I'm allowed to take up space.
Yeah, that's the best one.
And so there's like all these ones, they're daily affirmations, they pop up. And then you do a check-in to see how you're feeling. And then if you say, so you have 5, you have really bad, kind of bad, neutral, kind of happy, very happy. And I've had a couple of times like, I have a really bad period. It was really bad. And I picked bad. And it says, you can go to the first aid kit and it gives you things to help you. So whether it's like seeing the things in your environment, whether it's breathing exercises, or there's even in the corner a helpline so you can call for help.
That's
so
amazing.
I really love this. It's like, it's an independently created app. I've already recommended to 2 friends of mine with ADHD who are now using it. So it was dinging before we started recording, and it was my friend actually wanted to come and be friends with me. So brought her and her pet,
her little
came over. So I have a micro pet because what happened is Bluey went for a walk, which he does every day, and he brought back an egg. Mm. And what you do is you tie the egg to one of the goals that you have the most difficulty achieving. Mm-hmm. Mine is drinking water. So I tied it to drinking water because I want that egg to open. And it takes 7 days of doing the task.
Wow.
Not in a row, just 7 days.
Yeah.
Well, I did it in a row because I want this egg to open.
That's amazing.
I did 7 days in a row of drinking, I say like five times. So I drink like half my water bottle. And I got subwoofer the corgi is what happens from the egg. And subwoofer becomes one with music to overcome anxious thoughts. Some may find him dancing in the least expected moments. And that is my
That's
vibe.
Adorable. Are you able to play any of the sounds that I just heard? Because I feel like people need to hear them.
I'll press drinking water. Oh, wait. Bluey came back. So he says, the mountains here are he. Oh, I sent him to the Alps. Because then eventually when he's old enough, you can send him places. So he's a toddler. So I'm allowed to send him on to the Alps. The mountains here are so big, cheap. Seeing the mountains here feels so different than seeing them from the airplane. So then there's two options I can pick. Or I can make my own response. But the two options are, it'll be exciting to see what you discover at the Alps. Or you get a better sense of how tall the mountains are when you're at ground level.
Mm. Which one are you going
to
pick?
Well, I'd like to think it's exciting to see what you discover at the Alps, which will be more like curiosity. Which one do you think we should pick? You get better sense of how tall they are now that you're on the ground?
I kind of like that.
Okay, we'll pick that one for you.
Yeah, he commented on how it's how tall from the sky.
Yeah, so he gained curiosity.
Yay!
And then you can reflect on the story. You can send other people like good feelings and that kind of thing.
Well, I think I'm going to download this for myself, and I think I'll download this for Charlotte.
Yeah, and so he's hanging out. He has fairy wings and an old man's cap. That's what I dressed him in. And his corgi is like hanging with him. And when he's sleeping and you click on him, he snores. So
it's
really adorable.
Oh, well, that's great. Okay.
Yeah.
Going to download that. I just wanted to, because you named your Finch Bluey. There is a new episode of Bluey that came out that's like they're calling it the Bluey movie. It's 28 minutes versus 10 minutes. It's so good. So everybody go watch it. I haven't actually watched the whole thing. Charlotte made me watch the last 5 minutes. She's like, Mom, I'm watching Bluey. And it made me cry. I was like, oh, what happened? You have to see. And so then I watched it with her. And then I cried. And oh, it's so good. So we love you, Bluey.
I've heard so many good things. I love Bluey. That's why I named my bird Bluey.
Go watch Bluey. And thank you all for listening to today's episode of Brains. Brains is hosted and produced by Heather and Sarah Taylor. And our theme song is by our little brother, Depeche.
If you like what you hear, please rate and review us and tell your friends to tune in. You can reach us on Instagram or TikTok or Twitter at Brains Podcast, spelled BRAAINS Podcast. You can also go to our website, brainspodcast.com, where you can contact us, subscribe, and find out a little more about who we are and what we do. Until next time, I'm your host, Heather.
And I'm your host, Sarah.